Hey everyone, and welcome to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. Today we'll be reviewing the World 2020 qualifiers, previewing the Intercontinental Cup final and some other matches. And I'm joined, as always, for this by Cricket Europe's Andrew Dixon. Hi Andrew.
Hi Russ, hi everybody.
Let's start with the World 2020 qualifiers. Fantastic tournament. There were a few surprises. Certainly it started with a couple of upsets and they seemed to keep carry on. So let's start by talking about a couple of the teams that struggled. Canada, Kenya, Scotland, the high-performance program teams missing out or really on the qualification. Is that a surprise to you?
Scotland, it was a surprise. I think on our last episode, I did predict Scotland to qualify. Canada and Kenya was less of a surprise, but I didn't think they'd do as badly as they did. I thought they'd at least make the playoff stage, but in the end, they ended up playing in the 11th place playoff, missing out on getting through to the top five playoffs of each group, and very disappointed performance with those two teams. It's sort of hard to put your finger on exactly where the decline is, certainly for Canada. For Kenya, a little bit more easy. Kenya actually started the tournament relatively well. Steve Ticklow was playing a lot better than anybody expected him to, but I think it was more their bowling attack that let them down in some cases. The twice failed to defend scores of around 170. At this level, really, you should be defending 170 every time, and Kenya couldn't. Disappointed performance by them. Steve Ticklow did have a good tournament, but batted well and bowled well, sort of rolled back the years. And if this does end up being his last performance for Kenya, he's gone out on a personal high, at least, if not a high for Kenya. Scotland... Very, very surprising, I think, that they did so poorly. Obviously, lost to Bermuda on the opening day and never really... They sort of recovered towards the end of the tournament, but never really sort of got over that shock. It certainly was a shock. I think we both felt that Bermuda were unlikely to even win a game in the tournament, but they ended up winning two. But their only other win was against Denmark, so they didn't capitalise on that win over Scotland. And then Scotland, they beat Italy in the playoff stage, but then lost to the Netherlands. And it's looking not too good for Scottish cricket. I think there's a big fear that they might lose ODI status at the World Cup qualifier. There's still a bit of a puzzle as to what actually happens as regards ODI status after that World Cup qualifier. And obviously, that takes away ODI status from the game against England that they've got scheduled in May, which means England would then be free to make a bit of a mockery of that game and have one of these things where all 15 members of the squad are allowed to field and whatnot. But very disappointed for Scotland. Only just missed out, to be fair, on a place in the top three playoffs on net run rate once you took it to, I think, the fourth or fifth decimal place. So a very narrow miss for Scotland and getting to those top two. But in the end, they just weren't good enough.
I think with Scotland, I think if they'd made that top three, they almost certainly would have probably found their way through somehow, either by beating Hong Kong or whoever they played after that, probably PNG. I think they probably would have won that. They certainly had good performances. I think Matt McCann played particularly well, particularly towards the end. But I think it all three, it actually shows us how competitive this tournament was, because they all lost early games, and those early games just hurt them the entire way through. Canada obviously lost their first game to the USA, and then a close one against Ireland, and then that really, there was something way behind the eight ball right through. Kenya, as you said, they couldn't defend high totals. If they'd won even one of those games, I think they would have come in the top three themselves. So it's a great sign for Associate Cricket that it's so competitive, and that every single game in this tournament was pretty much a must-win for every side to maximise their chances of going through.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the tournament, Denmark were the only team not to win a game, and obviously disappointed for Denmark, but positive signs for most of the other teams. Bermuda did a lot better than everybody expected. Papua New Guinea played superbly. I think people suspected they might make the playoffs, but to do it in the way they did was very impressive. Obviously beating Kenya in their first game It was a big boost to them, and they beat the Netherlands as well. They beat Ireland in a warm-up game. So good signs for Papua New Guinea as they go ahead to the World Cup qualifier in New Zealand.
Yeah, let's talk about the three sides that probably surprise people who don't pay as much attention to this level, which is Nepal, who I think became a bit of a sweetheart team by the end of the tournament, PNG and Hong Kong. They're all young sides. They've all got a lot of players that have come through development programs. That, again, shows that that's the way to progress at associate cricket now. You can't just pick up some expat players to do well. You have to actually develop from a number of years to get to the level you need to be.
Yeah, and in the case of Hong Kong and Papua New Guinea, they've got a good mix of sort of youth and experience. Hong Kong have a few players who have been around the game for some time now, but they've got those up-and-coming young players like Irfan Ahmed, Jamie Atkinson, who of course made his debut for Warwickshire in the county championship this year. Signs, future's looking good for them. Papua New Guinea have a couple of players who have been in the side for quite a while now, but are still young, and obviously they've got the experience of Geraint Jones, the former England wicketkeeper, and signs are looking positive for them as well. And Nepal, very young team, but they've got some players, again, who have been around some time, come up through the under-19 team, the Nepal under-19 team that's been so successful in the past, not been as successful in the last few years. But they've got a lot, they're getting a lot more big match experience, and I think that showed in the closing stages of the tournament. Nepal, in the past, I suppose have been known, similar to South Africa in full member cricket, as a side that has a habit of choking in crucial situations. They often would lose semi-finals or crucial playoff games, but now they don't. We saw that in World League Division 3 earlier in the year, and we've seen it again in this tournament, and they're well-deserved qualifiers for, well, the next qualifier.
That's right. Obviously, it is another qualifier. How do you see the teams that have qualified going there? Can they upset Bangladesh and Zimbabwe and obviously Ireland and Afghanistan, who to me did seem probably a little bit ahead of everyone else, as we kind of expected?
Yeah, I mean, Ireland did start slowly. Obviously, they had that close game against Canada and a couple of other close encounters, I think, against the UAE as well. Zimbabwe, whose group Ireland will be in, are well below par. I think at one point during this tournament, the results had led to Zimbabwe actually being bottom of the ICC's 2020 international rankings, behind five associates who were in the rankings at the time Canada hadn't qualified, which shows just how far they've fallen. Not that we should pay too much close attention to the ICC rankings. Not the best ranking system in the world. I think Ireland should beat Zimbabwe. Netherlands have a good chance against Zimbabwe. Obviously, Netherlands beat Bangladesh last year. The UAE is another team in that group. I don't see the UAE beating Zimbabwe, but they could push them. It'd be interesting to see what happens if Zimbabwe do quite badly in that tournament, whether Zimbabwe would have to go through qualifying for the next World 2020, or if they'll just carry on getting their automatic place. And the same applies to Bangladesh in the other group, where they'll play Nepal, Hong Kong, Afghanistan, which looks like quite an interesting group. This would make a quite an interesting, say, qualifier for an Asia Cup tournament between these four teams. A few years ago, these teams were actually quite close together. About a decade ago. Obviously, Bangladesh have gone on to bigger and better things since then. But this could be an interesting group. I think Afghanistan, with their pace attack, could well challenge Bangladesh, but Bangladesh are playing on home soil, so you'd expect them to have knowledge of the local conditions. They'll have the crowd behind them as well. And that'll be another interesting group. I think Afghanistan have the best chance of coming through that group ahead of Bangladesh, but I think Bangladesh might just take it.
And obviously, there's a little bit of talk about the HPP funding and what that's managed to achieve and what it perhaps should achieve. And obviously going into the next qualifier, these teams, so there's a few teams in there that don't actually have it, so they're somewhat hamstrung in their ability to prepare, although they'll probably get a little bit of funding from the ICC. What's your thoughts on HPV funding? Has it achieved what we thought it was? Was it a poor direction that it took in the past 10 years?
I don't think it has achieved what it should for all the teams. It certainly has in the case of Ireland and possibly the Netherlands as well, and of course Afghanistan. But for the other three, for Kenya, for Scotland and Canada, it's hard to say that it has achieved. It's looking like they're going to be reforming it. I've seen a funding policy document for 2014, and reading between the lines, it seems that HVP funding can be withheld or reduced if you don't meet certain criteria. And hopefully they're going to start monitoring what countries are doing with the HVP funding a lot closer. And perhaps if you don't meet these guidelines, you lose some of the funding. And I suppose that's the way you want to do things. You know, the funding policy refers to you get a grant of up to this amount. Also, it does look like the HPP scheme is being expanded. The top six teams from this World Cup qualifier coming up, the 50-over World Cup qualifier, plus Ireland and Afghanistan, will get, I think it's $350,000 annually. And then the other teams that take part in that global qualifier will get, I think it's about $170,000 a year. So the HPP program is being extended. Not sure what that means as regards ODI status, but we'll see about that. I think the HPP funding has perhaps in the past been used to try and organise fixtures against full members, but those fixtures haven't been forthcoming. There was an expectation that they'd have at least one match against a full member a year, but that obviously hasn't happened. Teams are often going sort of 2 or even 3 years between matches against full members, and you know this fund should be used for, I think, what it's intended to be used for, is that's development, hiring coaches, getting development officers to go out and try and get more people interested in cricket in some of these countries. Certainly in, say, Canada, it should be used to get some youth cricket set up, something similar to what the US Youth Cricket Association are doing, perhaps get cricket into schools, things like that. And if the HPP funding becomes more targeted in that way, I think that's a good thing for the future.
Yeah, I think with when it first came in, there was an expectation, I think it still persists in some way, that that the problem with the Associated Nations was not that they had a lack of talent, but that they weren't playing enough games against high-quality opposition, and they just needed more funding for coaches, and that if you gave them this money to perform those two roles, then these nations would rise up to be at a level that's close to the bottom of the test and full member nations. And I think we've come around to perhaps an idea that maybe that's not actually the case, that most of these nations still do have very small playing pools and aren't necessarily going to reach that level even with an extra funding and more coaching and at a semi-professional level. And so therefore, they do actually need to spend this money on development and not just on coaching and their existing player bases, which I think certainly in Canada and Kenya's place, their money largely went to players who were at the peak of their careers and have now moved on. And in that sense, it was an investment in a playing base that's not actually borne any fruit down the line.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, you've seen what happened with Kenya. They used it to give contracts to players rather than to fund the up-and-coming players. And they've had to carry on relying on some old players who are past their best, and we've seen the results of that.
That's a big base of the tournament. Your highlights, what were the best things from your perspective?
Obviously, you've got to look at things like the centuries that took place. So there were 5 centuries in the tournament, and the highlight of them being probably William Porterfield's 127 against the USA. USA is still a poor team, but 127 in a 2020 game is a superb tournament. If that had been an official 2020 international, it would have been probably, I think, the third or maybe second highest score ever. So you can't ignore that. And this, you know, the centuries didn't come from the necessarily the players you'd expect them to. Certainly players that people that don't pay as close attention to associate cricket wouldn't expect. So you had Tony Ura of Papua New Guinea scoring a century against the Netherlands, Irfan Ahmed scoring a century against Canada for Hong Kong, and you know, a couple of other players got close. Stephen Taylor, Matt Make and Gareth Bergo got innings in the 90s, and those are highlights. Bowling, it's, you know, I mean, it's always hard to get good bowling in a 2020 national, but I think probably the highlight was Samuel Ashenwari against Kenya, taking 5 for 13, whilst appealing from cover for LBW, but that's another story. Steve Ticklow against Scotland in 8 balls, took 4 wickets for just 2 runs, quite a superb spell of spin bowling as Kenya beat Scotland quite convincingly in that match. Kenya humiliate Scotland was my headline, which didn't go down too well with our Scotland correspondent at Cricket Europe, but they did humiliate Scotland, to be fair. And you know, obviously Haseeb Amjad also got 5 wickets for 12 runs. Samuel Ashenwari, by the way, is 5-13. I think he's the fifth best bowling in 2020 internationals and the best by an associate player. So, yes, yeah, some very good bowling. Tim Murta in the semi-final against the UAE took 4 wickets, bowled superbly. He seems to finally be coming good for Ireland with the ball. For his first few matches, he didn't really do much, but seems to have turned a corner now, and now he's a crucial part of their lineup.
I mentioned there's quite a few young players that did well. I mentioned Matt McCann before. He's not super young. Paris Kaker's not super young either. He was a standout performer throughout. It's clear why Nepal fans worship him, because he is really the heartbeat of that team. But Charad Vasorka's finishing was remarkable. I think he won 3 games in the final over with 6s, which is some effort in a tournament when he only played 10 games. Other youth players stood out for you?
Yeah, I think those players, to his side, I think, obviously, Nepal have in the past been reliant on Paris Kadka, but there seems to be other players now coming through and doing a lot better, which is a good sign for them. It used to be, you know, get Paris Kadka out, you get the entire team out, and that's not the case anymore, and they're an improving side.
The format, we talked about it before, we said we were in favour of it, but to me it worked as well as could possibly be expected. The only criticism I might have of it is actually that for some reason, 2 teams didn't play on the final day, when you kind of hope that all teams should actually play at the same time in their group games, just as to stop any manipulation of the group standings. But I think I already said there were no dead games, and it turned out to be an extremely exciting group stage and an extremely exciting playoff.
Yeah, I think all in all, it's probably the best ever tournament the ICC have ever put on. And I count the full World Cups and World 2020s amongst that. Very close right up until the end. The final was probably the only... It was a bit of an anticlimax. In some ways, obviously, Ireland put on a superb score, scoring 225. But then Afghanistan didn't play too well. Trent Johnson was definitely a star player in that final, scoring 62 and then taking 3 wickets. Obviously, I think I said this would probably be a good match to go out on. Obviously, he's still going to carry on and play in the Intercontinental Cup final. There's a lot of people now hoping he'll play in Bangladesh, but I don't think that is, although he has unretired, I think, at least twice in the past. So, who knows?
Yeah, the semi-finals was a little bit of poor games as well. I think both the Nepal and the UAE were just happy by that stage that they'd done their job, and perhaps getting a bit tired, particularly for the UAE, a lot of experience, but players not used to playing so many games so quickly. So they were a bit down, which is disappointing because they were televised. But the players before that, the Nepal-Hong Kong qualifier match, was a real highlight for me. I think it was one of the best 2020 games I've seen, not necessarily for standard, but certainly for excitement.
Yeah, I'd certainly go for that. And again, what we were saying earlier about Nepal sometimes choking, this would be the sort of match that in the past they'd have lost. They wouldn't have managed to pull off that victory in the last over, and now they can. And we've got to congratulate them for that. And the UAE-Netherlands qualifying final wasn't a particularly exciting game, very low scoring. Netherlands were just rubbish, let's be honest, in that. They should have won that game, chasing 1-1-7 when you've got the sort of batting lineup there. Have Michael Swart and Peter Boren and Ben Cooper, very good 2020 batsmen. But, yeah, they just didn't play at all well in that match. Obviously, bounced back and beat Scotland in another qualifying final quite convincingly. But we already talked about Scotland's poor performance. I don't think we need to go into that anymore. And Hong Kong in their qualifying final against Papua New Guinea, a relatively close game. Hong Kong only won by 29 runs. And Papua New Guinea started very well. They had Hong Kong very much on the ropes at 19-4. And Hong Kong did very well to fight back and win that game. So some exciting matches and some not so exciting matches. But I suppose it's good that Associate Cricket got exposed to a wider audience through that televised stage.
Yeah, so let's move on to some of the worst things in the tournament, and I'm going to start with the coverage. The live stream in the group stage I thought was excellent. I thought the commentators were very well informed, and the coverage, the quality of the streams and so forth was very good. But the quality of the commentary, once we moved into the ESPN Star part, was, and the Sky hosting, was fairly bad. I think it's probably been polite.
Yeah, obviously Brian Murgatroyd, who did the closing stages of the streaming, stayed on as a commentator for this, and he did a very good job. He was certainly well informed. The other three commentators is an entirely different story. Paul Allen and Nick Knight knew nothing. Paul Allen had about six goes at pronouncing Paris Kadka's name, got it wrong every time. Like, eventually he just started calling him Paris, rather than even try and learn how to pronounce his name. And really, pronouncing the player's name should be the first thing that a commentator finds out how to do. And it's quite disgraceful. And I've not mentioned Waqar Yunis yet, who, I mean, he wasn't even bad. He was just, he's so below bad and just absolute terrible. I don't know how anybody thought he was a good commentator. He should have been sacked after the first match. He was just useless.
Yeah, the thing that I think annoys me the most with the commentary is that they tend to make a virtue of being ignorant of players. Saw that particularly in some of the hosting comments before the matches. If you don't know why the players are there, or you don't know that these teams play cricket, then you have no business being in the commentary box, because there's actually quite a lot of information available on these players and what's going on. And it's not a virtue to not know anything about them and say, oh, well, who knew that they'd be able to do this? Because lots of people know that they're able to do this. It's only the commentator that's obviously remaining in ignorance and displaying it to the world.
Yeah, Nick Knight at one point seemed surprised to learn that this tournament had been going on for 2 weeks before he showed up. And I mean, it's just a lack of preparation. I mean, I watched the World Baseball Classic earlier in the year, and you had commentators who had previously only commentated on Major League Baseball, but actually put in the effort to learn about some of the players they were watching. You'd see them, you know, quote people's statistics from the Dutch league or the Brazilian league, and it's just you don't have to know everything about a player. Just find out one thing about one player, even if it's just a useless bit of trivia. So and so did this once. He scored a century against this team from 50 balls or whatever. And just to find out something about the players But to know nothing is just unacceptable in this day and age. You have the internet, and you can just go on, type these players' names into Google, into Wikipedia, into Cricket Info, whatever, and find something out about the players. It's unacceptable to be ignorant in this day and age. And then to not know that they play cricket. I mean, Robert Croft on the Sky Sports coverage referred to Hong Kong as a team you don't expect to be playing cricket. They played a first international in 1866, before England. So, it's just unacceptable. It's ridiculous, and it's a poor reflection on them as individuals, and it's patronising, and it's not what this level of cricket deserves.
Other things that disappointed you in the tournament?
Whilst we're talking about the coverage, some of the website coverage was disappointing. Some of the scoring, the comment, and I say commentary, it was entirely automated, and the system couldn't cope with some things. There was an incident in one of Bermuda's early games, I think maybe even their first game against Scotland, or maybe their second game, where one of the players got man-caddied, running out backing up, for those who are not familiar with that term. But unfortunately, there was obviously no way for the system to actually record that, because obviously it doesn't count as a ball in the over. So you just see in the over, six dot balls or whatever, and then at the end of the over, the wickets have gone down one, but there's no explanation of what's happened, why that wicket has gone. And I think at one point the other year, Hong Kong-Nepal match, it was very exciting towards the end, but you wouldn't have known that looking at the text commentary. The guy made a joke on Twitter saying, they really got over the excitement of that finish. And I've done commentary for Cricket Europe, and it's not that hard to try and just put a little bit of colour in it, but I don't think they even wanted to. Yeah, they didn't want to have any difficulty in having to explain things, and it's especially annoying that they actually prevent people from commentating at the ground as well. You cannot go in and do commentary as an independent person, and if they want to prevent people from doing that, they have to provide a decent service of their own, and they weren't doing that.
The automated commentary doesn't provide sufficient information to know what's going on. It doesn't provide any more information than you don't already get from the scorecard, basically, because it says every four was a great shot, and regardless of whether it came off the edge, and every six was going out of the ground, regardless of whether it was caught on the boundary and stepped over or went 400 rows back. So it doesn't really tell you anything, and if it's not telling you anything, it's not of any value to me. It's good that the ICC is taking some control, I think, of more control over the scorecards, because I think that's been an issue with some of the providers, but they need to do a better job if they're going to do that as well.
Yeah, my favourite commentary was, no run, there is no run. that tells you nothing. The other no run was he hits it straight to the fielder. Well, what did the fielder do with it? Did it hit the fielder in the face, knock him out, and whatever? Or did the fielder juggle the ball and drop it? Was there and then throw the ball to the stumps and miss? And then they try to take a quick run, but nearly got run out of the other end. Or it's uninformative. I think at one point as well, the ball hit the helmet. I think it was a no ball. They'd run one, and then a throw came in and hit the helmet. And the commentary system just didn't know what to do. It froze for a couple of overs while they tried to figure out how they actually do that. I think the system hadn't been programmed to cope with it. I think the system was perhaps too prescribed. When I do commentary on Cricket Europe, there are things that you can't score. There's no button on our Cricket Europe software to say ball hit helmet, but you can just add five penalty runs manually and carry on. I think it was perhaps too automated and no way to override the automation in the event of mistakes. The other thing they were doing when surprisingly, admittedly for the UAE, there was rain delays, and they didn't put on that there was a rain delay. They just kept it there. And I think one occasion they did put on that there was a rain delay, but then didn't actually start the scoring of the match until after the rain delay. I think it was a Netherlands-Bermuda game, where the entire game was scored live. Well, the entire, I think, second innings was scored live after the match had been completed. And, yeah, errors happen in commentary. I understand that. Like I say, I've done it myself. But if there is an error, you should acknowledge that there's an error. You should acknowledge if there's technical difficulties. When I was at the European Under-19 Championship earlier this year, we had a problem with the server that hosts our commentary, and we weren't able to do live commentary for about 2 hours in the final. On the final day, and we were able to go on, put a note on the tournament website to say live commentary not available due to a server problem. And if there is an error, then acknowledge it. People appreciate knowing when there's an error. So like if there's a delay to a train or to a plane, if you're told that there's a reason, you feel less bad about the delay. And I think the same applies here. Acknowledge errors and but try not to make them happen in the first place.
The poor thing in this tournament for me was the performance of the African and American teams, and I think that might be reflective of their development efforts relative to the other regions, and also their ability to draw on the resources of the full members in those regions, and that is possibly going to become more of a problem as time wears on.
Yeah, it's certainly looking that way. And Africa employing Charlie Burke, the coach Hong Kong in Estonia, he's going to be their development officer now, and hopefully he can step in and make a difference. There's a decline in there. We were hoping that Uganda were coming up, but they didn't have too good a tournament in this tournament, and yeah, things aren't looking good. Namibia have played reasonably well, but they still seem well behind the pack. They finished in the top 10 in this tournament, but I don't think you'd say they were a top 10 associate side.
Yeah, they were a side that obviously they played Ireland first up, and again they lost and struggled, and they did kind of walk through the tournament, but given how they played 2 years ago, it was surprising. We knew they were struggling a little bit, and that kind of showed. Uganda surprised a little bit because they've done so well in World Cricket League Division 3 that they look quite poor. But the American sides particularly, I think they came three of the bottom four places, or bottom six places certainly. And that's a real worry, because that's an entire region, and it's the region has the by far the weakest in terms of wealth full member in the West Indies. So unlike PNG's ability to draw on the resources of Australia, where they've had a lot of players playing in Australia, they're playing in the South Australian domestic comp, and the ability of the Asian Cricket Council to help fund via some of the money they get from Indian playing in the Asia Cup, that helps them fund a lot of things, and obviously the England helps the European associates to a degree as well. We're certainly not seeing that in America, and with Canada slipping and the USA not really just treading water, I guess. It's possibly going to be a problem, and we would assume, because the way the playoffs went out, that they're probably going to lose a place in the next qualifier if it's 16 team.
Yeah, it's certainly looking that way, and there's a story emerged this morning that the USA might play in the West Indies 50-over domestic competition, which they certainly need, but I can't see them doing very well if they do play in that tournament. But they're in an awkward position to some extent, that, as you say, the West Indies don't have the resources to help in the same way that some other full members do. Although all four members could do better to help cricket at this level, the West Indies obviously can't. They have their own problems. And a lot of these countries now have internal problems. Bermuda have some problems internally with getting players to concentrate on cricket ahead of other sports. We've talked about the problems in the USA numerous times. We don't need to go into them again. Canada have problems with players who, by all accounts, are better than many members in the squad who aren't being picked. And players who have played high-level club cricket in England who can play, who are eligible to play for Canada, have come up through the Canadian development system even, and aren't being picked. And you have to wonder what needs to change. And if, you know, Canada certainly go on to lose their HPP status, the high-level HPP status of the World Cup qualifier, it could actually be the best thing to happen. It could actually give them the kick up the backside they need to realise that what they've been doing isn't working and to try and do something different.
Yeah, one thing's changed already, of course. Gus Logie's been moved on as coach and he's been replaced by Andy Pick, who's jumping around to America's at a very rapid rate at the moment.
Yeah, he lasted about 2 weeks as the US coach, I think, and now he's coaching Canada. He's coached the Canadian under-19 side in the past, and we'll see what sort of difference he can make. But we'll see how they do at the World Cup qualifier, but I wouldn't put my money on them qualifying.
Any final thoughts on the World 2020 qualifiers before we move on?
Sum up, it was a very exciting tournament, and if only all cricket tournaments were like this. Multiple games played in one day enabled you to, if one game wasn't too good, you could follow another one, and that's how it should be.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. Let's move on to some news. There was other cricket being played as well. Singapore and Malaysia played the Stan Nagaya Trophy, and Malaysia's won that 2-1. Your thoughts on this?
Firstly, as always, it's good to see that teams are organising cricket outside of the purview of ICC and regional tournaments. Malaysia quite dominated in the first game, won by 90 runs. Second game, affected by rain, ended up being a 20-20 game. Singapore batted very poorly, only managed 79 from 20 overs, which Malaysia had very little trouble knocking off. And Singapore did bounce back in the third game. Obviously, Malaysia made a couple of changes to their side. They were 139 for 7 when it started raining, and the game was abandoned from that point. The Duckworth Lewis target was 137, so they only just really creeped across in that game and got a win. And the same teams are going to be playing later this month in the Sadara Cup, where they'll play a 3-day game. Always good to see multi-day cricket outside the Intercontinental Cup. And obviously, two old rivals competing, and it's good to see that these local rivalries still exist. Obviously, USA, Canada resumed a couple of years ago. It's good to see that these matches outside of the purview of the ICC and Asian Cricket Council are still taking place.
There's also some news coming out of the ICC. They've announced the shortlist for the Player of the Year in the associate level. The four players nominated were Kevin O'Brien, Kyle Kurtzer, Ed Joyce, and Naros Mengel. Your thoughts?
This used to be the award that you give to Ryan Sentescarter because he was the only player they'd heard of, but obviously some more high profile players. I suspect either O'Brien or Joyce would get it for the simple reason, again, that they're the player that most of them have heard of. Ed Joyce has had a superb year for Ireland, to be fair, as he scored a fantastic century against Pakistan in an ODI earlier in the year. And it says, it does actually say a lot about the state of Irish cricket that nobody noticed that he didn't play in the World 2020 qualifier. He was back at home. I think his wife had just given birth to her child, and nobody noticed that he never actually turned up to play for Ireland. And says a lot about the strength of Irish cricket.
Like, I'm a little disappointed in this award because, one, they've only played selected four players when every other list has six, which hints it to me that they don't know enough of the players. It's obviously a short list, but it's a short list that's very much focused on teams that were playing in World Cricket League Division 1, and although obviously that's the highest form of associate cricket, it's almost as elitist as the test list in the sense that, or the test list itself, if you noticed, only had four different teams in that team. And there were very, very good performances throughout the associate world this year, and there were some tournaments that involved the best teams like Afghanistan and the UAE, such as the Asian 50 over competition in December, and obviously all the qualifying tournaments for the World 2020, and some players who really ought to have been named. Paras Kakkar is definitely on the tip of my tongue here. Shaman Umar is definitely on the tip of my tongue here, and they both had amazing years, and I can't believe that they couldn't have slid them in. It's an indicator that they aren't really paying attention to me.
Yeah, I think the other indication is that I believe they're only actually judging players on performance in one-day internationals and Intercontinental Cup matches and the World Cricket League Championship matches. So it's a very limited view of associate and affiliate cricket. As someone named on the press release as the media representative for associate and affiliate countries, called Leah Cartalli, who nobody I've spoken to has ever heard of. Certainly not someone who's... I've been writing about associate cricket now for the best part of 8 years, and I've never heard of this guy. Peter Della Penna told me he'd never heard of this guy. None of us at Cricket Europe have heard of him. I don't know if you've heard of him, but I've not been able to find anything he's ever written about associate and affiliate cricket. And obviously, he doesn't follow associate and affiliate cricket. This is his shortlist he's come up with.
Yeah, well, it's obviously very easy to look at the scorecards if you only look at certain games and come up with the names that scored the most runs, and I feel that we could do better than that, but obviously we'll have to keep waiting and hoping on that front. The other, obviously, news coming out is, as you see, it's not really been announced. The scorecard funding's been released for next year. There's no significant change in the rankings for most teams. The teams that have done well at tournaments that seem to and perform well have moved up a little bit. But I guess the most significant obvious change from looking at it is that more and more funding is going to be dependent on this scorecard system and less on straight-up grants. Is that a good thing?
I think it's a good thing and a bad thing. Firstly, coupled with this is a cull in teams that take part in tournaments. We've already spoken about this on previous episodes. The Americas region is reduced to just 9 teams. 13 teams have been kicked out of the European competitions. And despite that, an actual third of what goes into the scorecard funding is based on performance in tournaments, in World Cricket League and in regional tournaments. But if you're not participating in those tournaments, then you're not going to be able to get as much access to that third of funding. And a lot of it's based on participation as well, and the stories coming out of participation numbers being fudged as an article currently on Cricket Europe, which reveals that one associate board gave genuine participation numbers and was told by their regional development manager that those participation numbers were unacceptable, and when said that they were actually the genuine participation numbers, was told to inflate them. There's a lot of, they'll go to a school and do a demonstration of quick cricket to 200 kids, and then they count them as 200 participants. But they're not participants, really. They've just gone to a two-hour quick cricket session, and that's it. That's the end of their involvement. They're not actually moving on to playing in youth level for clubs and moving on to clubs themselves. And the other problem with these participation numbers is they take no account of the size of the population. This is quite a drastic example, but the Falkland Islands and Turkey actually have the same, pretty much the same participation numbers and are given the same rank on the scorecard. But Turkey's population is about 200 times that of the Falkland Islands. So actually, the Falkland Islands are doing an awful lot better than Turkey in at getting players to play. It's a similar situation with also the Falkland Islands. You know, it's a British overseas territory, so it has a cricket-playing culture. But you look at, say, two countries like Mexico and the Czech Republic. Mexico and Czech Republic, again, similar playing numbers, but Mexico's population is about 10 times that of the Czech Republic. So actually, the Czech Republic are doing better. There's too much concentration on raw numbers and not enough concentration on the context. You know, and I'm a data analyst in my day job, and I know that statistics are, to some extent, meaningless without context, and it's just the raw statistics that seem to determine the funding. Really, it should be the context of those statistics.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I think these things can cut it in both ways when you try and make it more complicated than numbers, but they have things like employment. And it's obviously much easier to employ people in a country with a low wage, and that means that you can inflate that number a little bit and then get more money and kind of a virtuous cycle of employment.
And it's also easier to employ people when you have more ICC funding, of course.
Yes, so. That's right. And that works against European countries. Canada obviously has for a long time said that their HPP funding is much harder to work with than for other countries, just because of the sheer geographical size of the country makes it and much harder for them to get the squad together and much harder for them to manage their leagues, and that kind of thing probably should be taken into consideration. I think it's very new, and I think they probably will work on those types of things. They've got to be careful that the amount of funding that they're, and if they're going to make it more strict, that it actually isn't accidentally penalising some nations that are trying to do their best and have some limitations on that.
Yeah, and there's various hoops that you have to jump through to even be able to have your funding. Plus, there's a usual thing about keeping your accurate financial records and things like that, which is the sort of thing you expect, although you will note that it's debatable whether the full members keep accurate financial records, certainly in the case of Zimbabwe and perhaps the West Indies and Bangladesh as well. And there's things like you have to have, and you're doing this in some cases with just $10,000 annual funding. You're expected to have a member of staff, even if it's just part-time, to answer calls and things like that. You've got to have a dedicated office with a phone line, an email address, and a fax machine. We'll gloss over the need to have a fax machine this far into the 21st century, but whatever the ICC insists on it. But another rule is that to be able to get access to ICC funding, you have to raise a figure of 10% of your total funding from both membership grants and scorecard, or in the case of an associate member, that's a minimum of $25,000. In the case of an affiliate member, it's a minimum of $2,500. So to get access to $10,000 of funding, you've got to raise $2,500 of your own money. But at the same time, the teams that are only getting this $10,000 of funding are the teams that aren't taking part in tournaments. And it's easier to get a sponsor. It's easier to get government funding if you're playing in a tournament that is a World Cup qualifier. Yeah, you might not actually get to the World Cup. You're quite unlikely to get to the World Cup, but it's more attractive to sponsors. It's more attractive to government funding than just a development program or a friendly against a neighbouring country. And there's the risk of a vicious circle emerging where they're focusing so much on development but not actually doing the things that can actually make them the money to be able to focus even more on development. There's nothing necessarily wrong with focusing on local development ahead of participation in tournaments, but you can't do that with the money that they're getting. And I mean, I think one of the reasons they did that was that they felt that countries were spending their funding solely on taking part in tournaments. And for me, the obvious answer there is, well, either stop making them spend their development money on tournaments and actually fund the tournaments directly themselves, or give them more money, but they've actually given them less money. The countries that are getting $10,000 funding last year got $15,000 funding. So that's a 50% cut in funding, and sorry, a 33% cut in funding, and working it out the wrong way around there. And what the ICC are doing does not seem to match what they're aiming to achieve, and I'm very worried at what the future of some of these tournaments, some of these teams low down the funding scorecard is. We could be leading to a cull in not just tournament participation, but in members of the ICC.
Yeah, it does make you wonder what the point of being a member of the ICC is if it's only going to provide a really small amount of funding and a lot of paperwork. It has to be worthwhile going back in the other end. And playing in a tournament, even if it's a very small one, is part of that worth, part of what makes it worthwhile. And you kind of would hope that they can be included in that family of nations that play in the tournament at even a small level. There has to be, I'd rather see them choose methods of them of playing that are cheaper than the regional level tournaments where they have to spend a lot of travel. Even if, I think if you look at something so that the Asian Football Confederation's early rounds are actually just a two-legged playoff between a whole bunch of teams that play and then get knocked out, including quite big nations like India. That would be perfectly acceptable as a way of getting through the first round of a tournament and just having a local two teams play each other and then that's it. And if it's unfortunate that that's all they get every 2 years, then that's a difficulty, but it's at least something. But I think just cuddling them completely is disappointing. The other thing I think is the ICC doesn't necessarily appreciate just how important these global tournaments are for their promotion and development. And I think some nations have not necessarily taken advantage of it. I think if you look at the increase in playing figures, they do actually follow World Cup in some nations, and they do take advantage of it. Namibia has won back in 2003, and Ireland certainly has taken advantage of the promotion they've got, particularly after they've won games. And if you look, I think Hong Kong is actually an interesting example of this. The ICC for years has been looking to try and increase the amount of exposure they get in China, and now they've got almost what they wanted. It's not China, but it's part of China, and it's right on their doorstep. And they're going to play in the World Cup, World 2020, and they're going to play a qualifier at the World 2020, which is really disappointing because that's the kind of thing that they need to take advantage of, and they're not necessarily doing so.
Yeah, and you look at, say, a team like Estonia, who only just missed out on getting into the semi-finals of the European Division 2 Championship last year, have a very good development system. They produce a lot of local players, probably more than some teams higher up, probably certainly more than, say, Italy or the US or Norway, but yet they kicked out of tournaments. They some of the teams being kicked out of tournaments have better development programs than some of the teams still in and at high levels in the ICC tournaments. And that just doesn't sit right with me. It seems unfair. If you're aiming to, one of the things we all want to see is cricket becoming more of a sport played by locals within a country. People use the term indigenous, and I don't particularly like that phrase. Has various insinuations behind it, but it's you want to see teams fielding these homegrown players, and ceasing to rely on the expat community and players with ancestry of that country. And some of these teams lower down who have been kicked out of tournaments are doing that better than some of the teams high up, and but when participation in tournaments and performance in those tournaments still makes up, I think it's the biggest contributor to that scorecard formula, and you have no way of improving that, and it's not looking good.
No, hopefully things will change, but we'll keep monitoring it and talking about it and see what happens. Let's move on to previews. The Intercontinental Cup final begins shortly. It'll be streamed again, which is great news for us. Squads have been released. Your thoughts on this? Is Ireland the favourite at this point?
I'd say so, given given what's going on in social cricket. Ireland do seem to finally be fighting off Afghanistan, but Afghanistan could give them a serious challenge. You know, they've got that pace attack that isn't often seen at associate level. But Ireland have some good bats, and they have all their county players, which they don't often have in Intercontinental Cup matches. So they can call on the likes of William Porterfield and Niall O'Brien and Tim Murtagh and so on and so forth, and George Dockrell, and which they don't always have during the Intercontinental Cup group stage. So I think it should be a good game. Obviously, it's a five-day game, not a test match, obviously. Quite why that is, I don't know, but it maybe should be classed as a test match. But, yeah, I think it's set to be an interesting game, and it would be good to be able to watch some of it.
Yeah, Afghanistan missing Hamid Hassan, who's injured again, may probably make the biggest difference there. They didn't seem to miss him too much at the World 2020 qualifiers because of their pace attack, but maybe in the final, and I think that's probably going to tip me towards Ireland and saying that they're better, although they probably would be the favourites anyway. The other tournaments that are going on at this stage are a little bit more of a mystery. The Asian Cricket Council's Under-19 Challenge is on. It's not the Asian Cricket Council's Under-19 Cup, which will be at the end of the month, but it's some of the small things. For some reason, it's not a qualifier for the Under-19s, which I'm not entirely sure for why, because it doesn't make sense for it not to be. But your thoughts on this? It was mentioned that Oman would particularly like to do well because they're pushing for associate status.
Yeah, and Singapore will be looking to do as well. They're in Singapore have ended up in quite an easy first round group. The other teams in their group are China and Iran. So you'd expect Singapore to come through that group quite easily. Oman, as you say, I think they're certainly looking to apply for associate status next year. And good performance in this tournament will certainly go a long way to them achieving that. You don't see any of the other teams doing too well. Bhutan, maybe, the Maldives, perhaps, but the other teams you don't see doing well at all. China, they're the great hope for the ICC, but they never seem to do particularly well. Probably worth mentioning, originally this tournament was set to include three non-members of the ICC. Tajikistan, Taiwan and I think Vietnam, but they've ended up, I think that was conditional on them getting affiliate membership for the ICC at the annual meeting this year, and obviously that didn't happen. But hopefully the Asian Cricket Council will continue working with those countries as they seek ICC membership. So yeah, it should be an interesting one, but I think the final will probably end up being Singapore against Oman.
The other tournaments that might be on, there's a scheduled Africa Women's T20 at the 14th and the 16th of December. I've heard that it might be in Kenya. I've also heard that it might be in Uganda, and I've heard that it might be in Namibia. So with absolutely no information on the African Cricket Association's website, it's a little bit of a mystery. I am sure that the under-19 African girls are playing this weekend. I think there's six teams involved in that. I certainly know Tanzania is one of them. But I don't have a lot of information about that at a playing level or in terms of what might happen. But best of luck for all those nations.
Yeah, best of luck to anybody trying to find out information about them as well. ICC Africa isn't exactly the best region at providing information about tournaments.
No,
as we've discussed before.
It's great to see an under-19 girls tournament being played, definitely. So it's... hopefully we'll be able to report on that in our next episode, and we might have a chat about the year that's gone when we come back to that. That's all I've got, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.